Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. Gosh, we've had some good Thursday night shows, haven't we? Anyway, that's the live show. That's January 31st, and we're going to continue on with last week, and then we're going to have some surprises.
A metaphysical, meditative point of view, but there's almost the same correlations. And I have a tendency to say that the metaphysical was done is a lot more accurate than the other way, and it was done almost 100 years ago. So this gives you an idea of how these higher inner dimensions, and this is exactly, totally correlating to the what the extraterrestrials also teach us. This came up from the metaphysical sciences on our own planet. Obviously, it had an extraterrestrial influence. Once again, what I was saying was that the atomic weight, the hydrogen is the simplest element that we know. It has an atomic weight of 1, and so we just took hydrogen and found that it had 18 ultimate atoms in it. Ultimate physical atoms in it. And then we went to the next complicated item, which was nitrogen. We found it had 261 elements in it. And we divided it by the 18, which is our standard of simplicity, the hydrogen atom. We came up with 12, and its atomic weight was 12.011. So there's a tremendous correlation here. Now, looking back at the hydrogen atom again, what's called the Niels Bohr orbit of the hydrogen atom, quantum mechanics. When the first shell level or energy level out from the nucleus, which we now have discovered is to have three particles in it rather than one, subatomic particles below the proton, they named it N, they call that level N2, the next level out M1, then they call the next level up -1, and then M8. And they found that each one of these differences refracted wavelengths of light. So they found there were vibratorial shift points at these different shell levels out to the electron. And of course, these shell levels change in their frequencies. And their frequency changes on the optical levels correlate to the seven colors of the rainbow, with green being out about halfway up to the edge of the atom as it's defined by quantum mechanics. Another interesting similarity and correlation. Now I'll get back to the reading. I've given you a little atomic update here. Now we'll get back to the simplistic side of what the astral plane is. And I'm going to repeat myself here just a little bit. Actually, I'll just move on. I'll repeat the last sentences here. The etheric region may be designated as the atomic and subatomic areas of the material world, invisible to human senses as now developed. Ether is nonetheless a substance born to the physical world, although raised to a higher vibratory octave than physical matter. This being so, it is gradually yielded up to material scientists many mysteries that for centuries have been known only to occultists or metaphysical scientists. It is quite otherwise with the desire or the astral world. Unlike the region of the ethers, the realm of the desire world is another plane of existence or beingness. It is not just a finer graduation of matter. Actually, it is not a material. It is astral. While it flows in and through the physical world, interpenetrating the chemical and etheric regions of the physical and constantly influencing all activities within the sphere, it is of a different nature and subject to laws other than those operating in either the physical world or the higher worlds of mind and spirit. Now, earlier I showed you how the etheric body attaches itself to the physical cells of the body by going through the little holes as a energy field or a plasma. And this, of course, these little holes are in the nuclear membrane of every single cell in the body or in the cells of anything that exists. Students unfamiliar with the theosophical terminology will have no difficulty understanding the desire world if they think of it as the world of the heart's desire or simply as the soul world. For this world, our state of consciousness, corresponds to what the Orthodox theology describes as hell and or heaven, where the spirit abides after physical death. Now remember, I already said that earlier that I said that when two or more people get together with their aura fields, their energy fields, the interchange creates the astral plane, and if a person goes out of body, they go into that interchange field. And that interchange field could be several people grouped together, and they could name that field a religious field and call it different denominations. And then, so then the person disincarnates, it goes into that denominated field by these other spirits that are on the physical side of it. The Egyptians, of course, got into that under great measures, and they created a huge cult behind it back thousands of years ago, of which supported many dynasties. This isn't the end, but this is just one thing. And then when that spirit is finished in limbo in that area, it reincarnates back into the physical level again. And this is a cycle. Rebirth and rebirth that you have to break. When you break that, of course, you get it out of the Earth's auric field, because the auric field of the Earth supports this kind of activity. The Orthodox heaven is a place of inconceivable bliss, every heart's desire being fulfilled through God's infinite goodness and love. The metaphysician prefers to give this place, the state of consciousness, another name. It is generally known in Western wisdom as the desire or the astral world. When in later infancy, the child begins to be conscious of its environment, at first it is not aware of the substance of things. It does not realize that certain solid objects can bruise the body or that sharp objects will pierce it, nor does it sense distance. Even when an adult is not able to perceive with his physical senses the atoms compromising the substance of material forms, including his own body. In a similar way, when first entering the desire world, untrained clairvoyants see its form, but not the nature of the substance of which these forms are composed. This being so, observations recorded are not uniform, some being of a clearer seeing and deeper understanding than others. This accounts for the variation in the visions of the church saints, who may be mystical seers, but not necessarily trained clairvoyants. Consequently, their conclusions are not always corroborated by the findings of the occult science who have made the study of that world. And of course, in the astral plane is also where the spaceships, the flying saucers, move into to move beyond light speeds, because you could call the astral plane the plane of light, but at that point it's an interdimensional consciousness and not something moving across an ether to create a span like light. And this plane has to cross a span in order to be observed. Like, it takes many years for the light to come from different stars to reach here, our nearest one 4.5 years. The desire world is composed of what may best be described as force matter. Unlike ether, desire substance is not just a finer graduation of chemical matter. Physical instruments cannot penetrate its secrets. It is the world of life, feeling, and emotion. As our bodies with our physiological functions consist of material substance, so our feelings, sensations, and emotions become a tangible form in the force matter of the desire world, each type having its own particular form, color, rate, and vibration. And we discussed all that earlier with the meditation, where we actually felt each emotion and discussed its source. Other than what we got down into the fifth plane of consciousness in the meditation, everything beyond that, like will, love, all those things, thinking, all those things were manifesting in the astral plane through these sets of emotions, but their source of essence came from the higher planes. The feeling itself, you might say, of these different emotions arises on a higher plane. The actual area where it's felt, for example, will doesn't originate on the astral plane, as you probably know by now, but it's felt on the astral plane. Yet on the plane of origination, will itself is not felt. It is just will, and it's a color, but it has, in order to be felt into the human consciousness, it has to get down to the fifth level by binding up and making itself very coarse of the five preceding planes below it. As our body with their... I read that part already. I'm just kind of skipping through this. The desire world is not a space-time realm. And this is, of course, this is where the scalar waves go. And the scalar waves do not have any time, as I've already said. And by the way, we've got some beautiful pictures of scalar waves now, too, that people can see. We've been able to photograph them. It belongs to what mathematicians call the fourth dimension. And what's the whole subject of this whole tape series is to get into the fourth dimension comfortably and out again. And the aura, the feeling body, is in fact a fourth dimensional body. its senses, sensations, are by very nature keener than those known to man when in a physical body, as evidence, for example, by the ecstasy accompanying the soul transporting experience known as illumination. The force matter of the desire world is in continuous motion, pulsating in bright kaleidoscopic array of ever-changing lights and colors. Its basic substance is soul light, out of which everything is formed. I might note that on my travels to the astral worlds, I have seen that they have suns, but the whole world is self-illuminating. There's no dark side. Where soul light is either partially or completely absent, there exists the condition spoken of in the Bible as outer darkness, where swells unregenerate spirits until purged of the base elements in their natures. This is the purgatorial region of the Catholic theology, the hell of the Protestant or Orthodoxy. Force matter, or basic soul light, is both positive and negative, masculine and feminine, in function. The terms fire and water is applied to the masculine and female principles respectively derived from the desire world. For here the masculine quantities now manifest in fiery glittering radiations familiar to every seer, while feminine soul qualities are visible as most exquisite colors seen in clouds of light having a distinctly watery appearance, a water such as no one on earth sees with a physical vision. As evolution advances, feminine souls display more and more of their fiery masculine qualities, while masculine souls take on the ethereal beauty of the feminine. In our present state of enfoldment, desire is the mainspring of action. It motivates our conduct and thought. Such being the case, angelic beings inhabiting the desire world are of prime importance to our development. Now, one thing I might say, even though that I've written here that desire is a manifesting thing to cause things to happen, will is the impelling mode of desire. And when you can get the desire portion out of the way and go straight to the willing force, you get more in touch with the true nature of what your destination is really going to be, and therefore you can achieve your goals with a far less number of obstacles than in the normal way of pursuing the desire path. In our present state of unfoldment, desire is a mainspring of action, as I already said. The dominant laws of the desire world are those of attraction, metamorphosis, and transformation. Of course, metamorphosis goes a lot in the insect kingdom, for the worm into the fly, the worm into the moth, the worm into the butterfly, depending on if it's the first, second, or third degree of metamorphosis. Adding to these laws of repulsion, the force of hate and self-assertion that prevails on the lowest levels of this world. Fairy tales are beautiful illustrations of ever-changing substance of this realm, where form is not fixed, as in the physical world, but constantly metamorphosizing. So there's another example that I gave in my writings. The desire world is the home of innumerable beings who operate in diverse, subtle ways to influence man by means of his desires and emotions. These activities are sensed, but their presence is unperceived by the mass majority of the people. To the activities of these denizens of that realm, man owes his inestimable opportunity for growth and through experience, but by which he is building increasing moral strength and beauty, achieving mental vivification. For in our present stage of development, the average man's mind is but dimly awakened. As previously stated, the principal element of the desire world is soul light, and the chief function of it, which is transmutation, metamorphosis. It is readily amenable to the power of thought. Both the archangels, the hierarchy of Capricorn, and the angels, hierarchy of the Aquarius, are active in the higher heavenly region of this world, where the Lucifers have charge in the lower purgatorial levels. The Lucifer's activities, however, are not confined to these levels, but are now extending into the heaven realms as well. How the two divisions of the desire world, the higher planes where the force of attraction holds sway, and the lower where the force of repulsion is dominant, are related to human experiences and the manner in which they operate, are the subject of this lesson. Man is a free agent. He can revel in unbridled passion, low desire. He can elect to live, as do the majority, by drawing to himself proportionate amounts of high and low desire substance. He can follow the spiritual path, as do aspirants, and thereby lay hold of transmuting, transforming powers, having their source in the higher planes of the desire world. In these higher planes is the fountain of life, the fountain of youth, long sought by the medieval alchemists, but entered only by those who gave their all to the quest. And then further on, I go into the sin body, and it's a very interesting dissertation. I'd recommend that you read it for yourself, because there's diagrams, and I don't want to get into it, but it goes into the natural desires of the elements that compose the body, meaning that your body is made up of minerals. You know, 5% of your minerals controls 95% of your metabolic functions. Well, the minerals are subject to the elementals, and the desires are the elementals that are returned to the ground. So the quicker your body goes back in the ground, the more quickly it's satisfied in the desire of the summation of all the elementals that compose your body. And of course, these can lead your body into destructive habits to destroy itself, so that it can be returning back to the earth. And that's where the desire for the lower side is expressed. And you got to learn through the book, which will show you the characteristics of that, and through the book Death of Ignorance, you can go on into and understand a lot more about this, so you can get past that. Because the real thing to do is to teach the body not to have that desire, to raise the desire. Return to the earth to a transmuting notion whereby the earth and the elementals are transmuted into a higher consciousness, rather than the elementals fearing this transmutation that the spirit's going through in their vehicle or their loaned out vehicle. And these are the kinds of things I get into in Death of Ignorance, but they're not basically the subject of extraterrestrial sciences. They're things that I learned along the way on the path of becoming someone who became a contactee. Now, as we come into the next phase of the human body here, we're going to talk about blood. Blood, you realize, circulates through the body, and without it, we wouldn't be in our bodies. Blood reproduces itself, the red blood cell in the body, every 90 days. It's one of the first complete cell structure groups that reproduces itself. Like I said earlier in the nutritional section, a lot of times when people become iron deficient or anemic, it's because they start taking iron to compensate for that, and it doesn't do any good, because they don't put in vitamin E, which is an antioxidant, which holds the oxygen in the blood for a period long enough for the cell to reproduce in its fullness. And if you don't have this happening, what happens is the body is going to reproduce.
Agglutinogen in the red blood cells, which coagulates or clots when exposed to different types of agglutinins in the plasma. If you're doing a transfusion, for example, it's important to know the different blood types. A transfers to A. I know that mine is A positive. B to B is okay. O to O, type O, is okay. O, by the way, has no agglutinins in it. It's called the universal donor. And AB is the universal acceptor. Now, one thing that's important in a transfusion, which a lot of people don't take into consideration yet, and this is why, and especially with the transferring of organs, is the astrology sign of someone is not oftentimes taken into consideration. And this is another factor in blood transfusion and in organ transfusion, because if the astrological sign is taken into consideration of the donor, and it's matched with that of the acceptor, the astral energies are much closer. And if you remember
from our meditation that the astral precedes the etheric, and the etheric, of course, on its different levels, then goes into the healing of the body and the acceptance of different things in that particular person's body. And if, of course, the etheric and the astral levels are wrong, the acceptance on the physical is going to be very hard, and therefore the body is going to reject the blood transfusion or the organ donation. Now, the antibodies are manufactured in the blood cells, and there are different types. There's the gluitins, which we just mentioned. They cause clotting or grouping of antigens. The opsonins, which increase the activity of the eating cells, which are called the phagocytes, which engulf the antigens. Then there's the bacteriocins, which dissolves the antigens, and the antitoxins, which neutralize the antigen poisons. And I remember that one thing that happens in the body is that it receives a lot of antigens from time to time when you eat the wrong kinds of food, and niacin helps the body to get rid of this problem. The different types of the reactions to bad conditions of the blood, of course, you would have the leukemia, which would be a disease, which is an excess increase in the white blood cells. Then you have granulocytopenia, which is a decrease in the white blood cells, which is the opposite. You have polycythemia, which is the excess of red blood cells. And of course, anemia, which is a lot of people have that problem, that's oxygen failure. This is the lack of red blood cells or hemoglobin, and this is, of course, things that, when the pyramid is worn on the head and the brain is discharged of toxins that build up in it, because this problem of the brain retaining toxins over the period of years, it helps to relieve the symptoms of anemia. So a lot of these different things can be dealt with. Then there's hemophilia, which is a hereditary disease, which is a failure of the blood to clot. People are called bleeders. And of course, blood poisoning, which is called septicemia, where bacteria and blood cause local points of infection and congestion. And then, of course, you have terminal toxemia, which is caused by toxic substances. And these are the kinds of things that happen to blood. And of course, when we deal with the different kinds of healing energies from the extraterrestrial sciences, we are building the system up where it is so powerful that it is typically not subject to these kinds of infections. Now, when we look at the body, the blood's going through it. First of all, looking at a hemoglobin, it's composed of four different iron atoms. And you could just imagine that as four pyramids with the tops and bottoms, being the full octahedron, stacked on top of each other. One, two, three, four. Four octahedrons. And wrapped around these four octahedrons are two alpha chains and two beta chains, which make up the ability of the blood to transfer or oxygen into the cells of the body, or to pick up carbon dioxide and bring it back out and discharge it into the air for the plant kingdom to realize. Now, when you get into this action, this switching action, it's a rhythm of picking up oxygen and dropping off oxygen. It's a rhythm. And it goes boom, 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 like that. And if you remember back in the meditation part, there are some rhythms in there that are very similar to this rhythm. And this rhythm, of course, is regulated through the pineal gland. And in the death process, the rhythm is slowed down, so that the astral body the consciousness can start shifting from the physical body to the astral body. And the first phase of the shift takes place when the oxygen no longer is capable of moving through the body properly, and the physical consciousness is no longer able to lock down or sustain itself or anchor itself in the physical body. The soul then starts moving its consciousness towards the astral plane. But the effect of the blood, the oxygen, back and forth switching action is called the Bohr effect. And it's not the same Bohr effect as we talk about in quantum mechanics. Now, looking back at the iron, again, in the blood, which is the nucleus of the blood, the iron is two things.
It's ferrous and ferric. And if you were to take a frying pan, for example, and to rub off some of the dark metal on it where it's kind of blackened, and expose it to light for a little while, what you would find is that in a little while, this shiny frying pan surface that you, when you ran over with, steel wool, or rubbed it with steel wool, it would get shiny. And when the shine was left out to air for any length of time, what would happen is it would not be so shiny any longer, start to rust. When it rusts, the oxygen goes in there and oxidizes the iron, and it becomes iron oxide, meaning it is then, in this case, ferric, meaning it has a valence of +3, or all of its electrons available in that ring to fill that orbital pattern of that particular ring of the combination of oxygen and iron are complete. Then, if you were to rub it shiny again, it would become active again, and it would be ferrous. And it would be looking for another electron to fulfill its outer orbit. And of course, then once this orbit was filled, it would go from ferrous to ferric again. This is specifically how it works when you realize that it's picking up oxygen when it's in the active standpoint. It's like you just rubbed the frying pan. Now the blood comes up in the lungs. It's in that state. Ferric state, and as soon as it combines with oxygen, it goes into the ferrous state and goes back down into the body, bringing the oxygen down to the body, which then it connects up with the different cells in the body and goes from the ferrous to the ferric state and comes back up again. So it's constantly going from the ferric state, where it wants to, where it is complete with carbon monoxide, back to the ferrous state, where it discharges the carbon monoxide and becomes active again, looking for more oxygen. And this is the action of the iron atom in the body. So this switching of from ferric to ferrous is a rhythm pattern, and it's called the Bohr effect. As I said earlier, as in old age or when the death hormone sounds, this process is interrupted. Now, this is the mechanical state of blood, the way that blood works in the body on a mechanical level. Now, of course, it works on other levels besides the mechanical level. Blood, you know, looking now at the shape of the iron atom itself, for example, in the iron atom, of course, as we said, is the shape of the pyramid. Well, looking at this shape, what happens is you got to realize that we're looking at a pyramid here, and this pyramid has seven different levels of energy fields in it that we discussed in our meditation that come into the red blood cell. And if you remember the story of Christ, and when he was initiated in the Great Pyramid, he went into the seven different chambers and had seven different experiences, because in the initiation process of the Great Pyramid, what happened, the pyramid itself is so well centered on the face of the earth where it's located that it can't help but be a total source of bringing that energy from the higher planes or the inner planes out to the physical plane. And so if you go into one particular area of the Great Pyramid, like for example, if you go in the Queen's Chamber, you're up on this Ray 2, and you're going to have a Ray 2 experience, which is as with the experience of the sun. And if you go up into the King's Chamber, you're going to have a Ray 1 or a Father of Will experience, because it's bringing you to that level of consciousness. Of course, this is the advantage of having something built in the exact geometric center of the earth. If you were to take all the land masses of the earth and all the valleys and all of the hills or mountains from the Marianas Trench to the top of Mount Everest and average it out, you'd find that the Great Pyramid is 454 feet tall. And the average of these two areas, the land masses above and below the sea, it averages out 455 feet. If you were to look at the King's Chamber and see that it's 68 degrees year-round, the best temperature for the outside of the human body year-round, for the highest amount of consciousness, least amount of air, oxygen, or food requirements is 68 degrees. You go on and on and on. You begin to realize that the Great Pyramid has a lot of significance, and that significance is not stopped on its physical comparisons to the geometrics of the earth pyramid relationship. It also, as we discussed earlier, had to do with the rotation around the Pleiades. It defines that.
It defines just about everything that has to do with the carbon atom. So in its perfection, when you're actually in the Great Pyramid, it's not so impossible to experience these levels or changes in consciousness like Christ went through. So now if you were to project all of these energy fields from the Great Pyramid into the red blood cell, you realize that the red blood cell with its four iron atoms, which has four positive and four negative energy fields around it, because there's four of them, you end up with a perfect synthesis of this seven levels of energy being synthesized right inside the iron atom or the carbon atom in the body. And because the iron atom is shaped like a pyramid in the body, it has the seven levels of consciousness on the small level represented in each and every red blood cell of the body. So as this blood is pumped through the body by the heart, this consciousness is then dissipated through the body, all seven levels. And depending where in vibratory frequency that the cell structures that it's dissipating its energy into are tuned to, remember we talked about tuning up the DNA of the cells, depending on where the bulk of that tuning is, will be determining where the bulk of that consciousness from that iron shape, the iron atom, is distributing itself into the body. And as a result of that, the blood becomes then the spiritual life threading force. Because if you didn't have these seven levels of energy coming onto the physical plane somewhere, then you could not have no physical plane consciousness. And it just so happens these physical things come onto the physical plane in the human being through the action of the red blood cell. So now you begin to realize that we are weaving a spiritual thread through the body, and that's why it's so critical, because when blood stops going through the brain no longer receives spiritual information from the seven levels and is no longer animated or vitalized from these seven levels, and the brain starts to die. When the brain starts to die, then the rest of the physical body starts to die, and therefore you have a loss of consciousness. A lot of people don't really appreciate blood on this level, but that, in fact, is where it's coming from. And that's why when you get into blood typing and that, it's important to realize the different characteristics of that person's body. You could call a body an interface between the spirit and the form. And the body has its temperament, and that's our right to be individuals, having and exercising that right of temperance. So these are some of the kinds of things that have to do with the blood flow in the body. So, overall, we begin to see the importance of blood, and just reiterating what we've talked about so far is the fact that on a chemical level it goes from ferrous to ferric and back again, meaning that it transfers oxygen into the body, drops it off, picks up carbon dioxide, brings it back out, and discharges that back up into the air. On another level, the pyramid being the shape of the iron atom, drop seven levels of consciousness through the body, and depending on what cell is tuned to what frequency, that consciousness is amplified, i.e., the consciousness of the sexual organs would be organized, you know, more on the seventh ray, the violet, so therefore it would have a tendency to pick up the energy down on the seventh ray, or the seventh plane, and the sixth plane, the astral plane, whereas if it gets up pituitary, it's going to be energized more up on ray three, which is the ray of intellect. And if you remember back when we talked about the structure of the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, we talked about each DNA in each particular cell, if it unwound, was 39.5 inches, and that has got the chromosomes laying over it, and the chromosomes, of course, act as small radio transformers, and they transform depending on what the chromosome tuning is, 46 different chromosomes. And then there's 1,250 different genes working below them, and they, of course, are tuned in to the mechanically, they are tuned into the right wavelength to receive that electrical etheric impulse that comes into the body, to receive that particular vibratory frequency. So even though we're looking at a 39.5 centimeter long antenna, it's got a tank circuit at the bottom, meaning that it is tuned to a particular section along that way, so that electronically it can receive these signals that are brought in through the action of iron. Now the next way to look at blood in the body is to look at it in the fact that because it's iron and it's flowing in big long capillaries, and veins throughout the body, and it's iron, obviously, it's going to be able to carry a magnetic field. And so if you realize that the blood circulating throughout the body and parallel to the blood circulation, of course, is the central nervous system of three different nervous networks that we talked about, the autonomic, parasympathetic, and sympathetic nervous system, and they are conducting electricity. Naturally, the nervous system is going to induce electricity into the red blood cell, and of course, the red blood cell, being iron, basically is going to carry also a magnetic field. And when you get up into the brain, this has a tremendous significance, because it's in the brain that the magnetic field of the blood circulates through the different cavities that have been formed by memory programming, which we'll get into a little bit later. And as the aura field, the electrical aura field caused by the central nervous system, scans these different cavities in the brain, it's able to pick up electrical imprints or blueprints of consciousness that then transform into direct memory patterns or direct memory thoughts. Now, when you look at an infant, when a child is first born, the child is very curious. You realize that the high self, the child, and the organized consciousness has not been able to infiltrate down into the physical form of the child yet, meaning that a child's past memories, higher consciousness, awareness of things that already are, is not expressible into its consciousness that's being expressed, because the body has not been fabricated and connected yet to this higher realm. So what has to happen is a series of what we call growth patterns established, where a reconnection is made between the higher self and the higher existence of the being and the lower self. And depending on this power or the perfectness of the connection determines the frequency of the soul and the karma of the individual. And the whole alignment of the soul process into the form has to do with spiritual growth on this planet. So the child wants to learn things. The will, first of all, first ray, is pushing through the child's consciousness. The child is curious and locks up, for example, a table and says, "What's that?" And of course, the fovea of the eyes are focused on the table. It's burning through the retinal nervous part of the body, through the retinal optic passageways. It's burning a little area into the gray matter at this point. It's like a singeing thing going on in the fats of the body where the light hits the fat in the brain. And then the mother or father comes up and says, "Oh, well, that's a table." The child's pointing to the table. So now the child hears table, seeing table, hearing table. Now the ear part system of the body starts to hear, when the olfactory nerves start to hear the word table. And this is a reinforcement. And I realize that consciousness is probably focused on vision. So the child now hears the word table and sees the table, and then probably the next thing the child will do is go over and touch it. So now three senses, sight, hearing, and touch, and maybe the table has some kind of exotic wax on it, and the child can even smell the wax on the table. The bottom line is that there's a three or four way stimulation of the senses into to the same area of focus, because of vision. And if the person is blind, of course, it's probably centered on audio. And if it's not, if the person is blind and deaf, of course, then the person has to go by feel, which takes even longer. But it all depends on what sense that the focusing process is keynoting on. But usually it's the vision. So now the child has the idea that if it sees this table again, so this is going to be table. Anytime a child sees something as of a form and a feel, this is a table. And that's probably going to remain pretty consistent from that point on in the child's life. And I realized that all of this focus of all these different senses into this one area, which was keynoted on the vision, into the gray matter of the brain, has burnt. You know, it's optically, it's like shooting a laser into a piece of plastic. If it's strong enough, it'll burn a hole. This has burnt an impression of the table into the brain. It doesn't mean it's the visual impression that the child saw it, but it's an impression in the brain that the brain can interpret to retransmit back when the child recalls it, the vision of the table and the sense of the table. And, of course, when this happens, the child now has memory. You know, if you look at the mechanical part of the blood playing in all this, and the gray matter, which was virgin at that point in time, the gray matter was then responding by having an etching going on from this impact of the senses through the nervous system through the gray matter. And from that point on, blood will, any time it flows through that part of the brain, will be slightly diverted from its normal path into this little recession that's been etched in there in the image of the table. And once again, I specify that the image is not the image as you would look at it or draw it, but the image that the body responds to when it's swept by the thought process. Sweeping meaning moving that consciousness, looking for analysis across the brain pattern. And so, table is now formed, and on a magnetic level, because iron, as we said, was already present in the blood, when it's pumped through and struck by electricity, which comes from the nervous system, the iron is going to put out a magnetic pattern, similar to a computer memory, core memory in the computer. So as a result, table is there. And pretty soon the child goes through and becomes familiar with all objects. And then, so therefore, an area of the brain has been familiarized by these different objects and the identifications. Then the child goes out and meets another child. And the child, say they have a little conflict, and one child pushes the other child down. And the child gets pushed down, gets up, pushes the other child back. Well, he realizes that this wasn't comfortable. So now through the stimulus of the unpleasancies and the opposite, of course, the euphorics, the smelling of flour and these kind of things. And I always put the dark side out first. It's not my nature. Then what happens is what you experience is a complete learning set of learning experiences and encounters with another person. So this is another area of the brain that gets galvanized by thought. And so pretty soon what happens is you have a complete memory of objects and thoughts and experiences. So we've got two areas of the brain. Now you realize that in the object area, where all these things were identified, tables, chairs, and all these kinds of things, pretty soon there's a lot of electricity in that area of the brain because it's a whole new area that's carved out. Now let's say, for example, the child got hurt, had an abrasion on the head or a slight concussion, and it wiped out or damaged part of that area of the gray matter. So the child lost recollection of certain objects. It depends on how advanced the child was, whether that recollection would be reconstructed in that area, or the brain may choose another area, and the child may have to go through a therapy program, or an adult too, to re-establish certain things that were known previous to the injury. Another thing that's real interesting is the factor of time. Somebody would walk up to Fred Bell and say, "This is a table." Fred Bell would realize not only that this is a table, but he'd realize it might be a Victorian table built back in the 15th century or 16th century, or it might be a table from a cave that a caveman built back in, 5,000 years ago, and he would identify the type of wood, maybe it's rose, walnut, oak, and all these different kinds of things, and that would give him a consortium of time identification and heritage, identification. So I would look into it, not just as a table, but what kind of a table it is and who built it, and I would automatically think and link up whole series of events that took place by human action to create the table in the first place. And this, of course, is the way the bulk of humanity works. And this linking of thoughts together holds thought over a period of time in a dimension with its correlating traditional building blocks to interpret its full meaning at the moment that it's exposed. And this is where you start linking in time with the expression of memory. And, of course, I'm not going to get into it in great detail at this point in time, but as you can understand, it has ramifications that once you realize this process, you can free yourself of that process and move out into a space where time is not yet present in the human mind. And this, of course, is the science of time travel. Now, looking back at the human being, we realize that now the human has this child, has their objects, has had experiences. We move forward, and the child begins to project into the future a possibility of different kinds of reactions. Through the series of projections the child is presenting itself to, is developed what we call gut feeling, intuition, these kinds of things, and that part of the brain becomes active. Now we've got three areas of the brain, the intuitive brain area active, the object identification area active, and we've got the possible encounter, our personality system, area of the brain active. When these three systems become activated, what happens is now by spontaneity, remember we talked about earlier about time as being a spiral earlier on in this tape series, that time doesn't repeat itself. We were talking about Phi and the Great Pyramid. We're talking about Pi, that the timeline is not a circle, but it's a spiral. Then you realize that consciousness, you know, impeding down on these three different galvanized areas of the brain has been a tendency to start projecting a fourth area of the brain. And this fourth area, when it's activated, makes the person into a channel, a seer, a mystic, or any of the other kinds of things that are associated with something up and above and beyond the stimuli and experience action of the three-dimensional world that we live in. This, of course, when it's recognized as a possibility and then a reality, becomes a fourth-dimensional or timeless aspect. Now, timeless meaning that time is slowed down in this area, because as you move up in frequency, vibration, and consciousness, time begins to slow. You get up into the consciousness of the solar logos, for example, the one whose being is our whole solar system, and we're just cells inside of cells in his body. Well, you know, he might be just taking a nap, and it's 3 billion years for us. So you realize that there's another time link here, but it dispels us of the paradox of the bulk of humanity's consciousness and frees us, at least time-wise, from the bulk of humanity's problems and forms of ignorance that hold us back in our spiritual upward spiral. So now we're starting to talk a little bit more about time travel, and if you remember back previous to this, when I talked about the spirit hitting the body, locking down the shock of it as it enters the chakras, and then the lockdown of the shock, some of it spent down into the body and trapped. Some of the energy is freed back to the spiritual kingdoms. And hopefully you'll start to put this tape series together, these ideas together, because a tremendous amount of things are being... Now, I could probably maybe consolidate this down a little bit further, but I feel it's necessary for you to present it at a certain level that will give you the freedom to put it together for yourself, because the way I interpret what I'm saying to you, the listener, and the way you interpret what I'm saying to you could vary. And if I lock it down too quick and too solid and the configuration becomes too fixed, I think that you'll lose the freedom to interpret and analyze what I've said and deviate with the amount of your own personal interpretation what's necessary for your own ego and your own spiritual requirements to resolve the bottom line. Back in 1948, there was a reconnaissance plane flown by the Navy over Verdant Cumberland Valley in back east in Pennsylvania, and it took pictures of a series of crops that had been blighted by locusts. And this is during the time we had these locust plagues. The pictures that were taken of these orchards from a pretty good altitude were then taken to a laboratory, the Homeotronic Naval Laboratory in Newport News, Pennsylvania. Newport, Pennsylvania. And they were studied, and were given to a farmer whose crops crops had been photographed in a black box, and they were in the black box they put in some insecticide, and the technicians in the laboratory told the farmer to leave the pictures in the box all the time, but every day at a certain time turn a dial on the black box. After 6 weeks went by, every single insect in the orchard had been destroyed by a combination of energy of what was coming from the black box, the picture, and the insecticide that was placed in there. And this, of course, was the beginning of the what we would call psionic energy or scalar wave technology that became, much more prevalent today, matter of fact, in our paradigm systems. T.J. and Hieronymus was the one that had applied for patents. It was his system they were experimenting with in 1946. They were issued in 1948, patent number. If you want to call the patent office and see yourself what this is 2,482,773. It's 2,482,773. That patent number is the patent that a lot of our systems, equipment, and paradigm operates under the aegis of.
This seminar series is continued on the next tape.
Well, we're kind of running out of time here. We'll play a little bit more of the other side, and then that'll be the end of the tape. My goodness. That was 50 quick minutes there. That's all I can say. 50 very quick minutes. 51 very quick minutes. Anyway, we'll see if there's something else coming up here. And then next week we will start a new... Oh, by the way, don't forget to catch me on George and Ori, our Bell Show, Friday, February 4th, at 11 o'clock till 1, 2, 2 o'clock in the morning. We'll be looking forward to the show. And you can get it on your local radio station. It's KFI 640 in Southern California. So anyway, there's the Pleiadian ship warming up, and we'll have a couple more minutes, and we're done for the day.
We have the physical mechanism and the vital body which gives it life and animation. But the physical body itself is a heartless, senseless thing that we have produced. It has organs of sense, but it cannot use them. It does know the fragrance of flowers. The inspiration brought about the order of pines. It has lips and tongue and vocal cords, but it cannot utter a word. Each of its eyes has a half a million nerve fibers leading to the brain and several million rods and cones to light impressions from the retina, which have been transformed into electrical impulses, but there is no consciousness of the glories that the vision brings. The ears are ready to catch the sound around it, the eardrum, all nature's amazing devices, but only vibrations reaching the awaiting mechanism, and there is nothing to turn them into sweet cadences of melodious sound that man can contact and respond with ecstatic joy. To supply this need, let us go beyond the physical realms and get more into the extraterrestrial science and to the collection of the vehicles of human consciousness that we have assembled. We must add a few more so man may stand up and become complete. And of course, pretty soon we're going to go into the human brain on a much heavier level. But right now, we're getting ready to get into the astral body. Now, the name astral is not something that I've picked up. We inherited it from the medieval alchemists. It signifies starry and is supposed to have been applied to the matter of the plane next above the physical because of the luminous appearance which is associated with the more rapid rate of its vibration. And when I said this, we went up into consciousness and more inward, the energy levels go up. And so vibratory rate goes up. The astral plane is the world of passion, of emotion and sensation. And it is through man's vehicle on this plane that all his feelings exhibit themselves to the clairvoyant investigator. The astral body of man is therefore continually changing in appearance as his emotions change, as I shall reiterate upon now. Now, so far we have observed that the ethers of the threshold of the ordinary perceived physical world are simply a rarefied condition of matter. Slight physical development is required for their investigation. In fact, thousands of people who have given no special thought to either psychic or spiritual development, have seen and are continually seeing one or more of them without knowing there is anything unusual about the experience. As the Aquarian age draws near, the number of persons sensitive to the finer ethers, the consciousness in this area is going to increase year by year. And that's the neat thing about our systems, is the fact that systems help increase that consciousness, but not only on the etheric levels, also on the astral levels too. Even now, there are cases on record among pioneering scientists where etheric vision is momentarily opened in the course of particular investigations. This was well demonstrated at Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland with the discovery of lysergic acid, LSD, in the rye mold. The etheric region may be designated as the atomic and subatomic areas of the material world, invisible to the human senses now developed. Ether is nonetheless the substance born in the physical world, though raised to a higher vibratory octave than physical matter. Thus being so, it is gradually yielded up to material scientists. Many mysteries for centuries that have been known only to the metaphysical community. Now, one thing that's really interesting is the science has gotten to the point where science recognizes that there's a relationship between the experiment and the experimenter. And if you read Popular Science or Scientific American or any of the magazines or scientific journals that go into the exploitation of different kinds of things that happen in scientists' worlds these days, you'll find that they're discovering and naming subatomic particles. For example, they're calling some particles strangeness, charm, up, down. All these different particles are beauty, truth, justice. All these different names have a psychological influence or an attribute because they are starting to find out for a fact that there is a relationship between consciousness and particles. And then when you go up into the astral plane, the particles that are on their way down to the physical plane also have characteristics too, which haven't truly been named yet, other than they call them hadrons, quarks, or higher up on the astral plane, what's where coloring takes place, we get into the level of omega. Now, I'm sure all of you remember the meditation tape that we did. And when we experience different levels of consciousness, and we talk about that consciousness, one of its attributes is moving into our psych systems through the hydrogen atom. If we were to look at the hydrogen atom, for example, we would see that there are a proton for a nucleus and an electron for the electron for the energy going around, like the sun and moon relationship, or the earth and the moon relationship. If we were going into it a little bit deeper, we would find that, and we were to study quantum mechanics, we would find that quantum mechanics designates energy levels from the electron down to the proton. And the outer levels are called M8, M-8. The lower levels, the middle levels where green is M-1. In further energy level M1 and then M2. These, of course, energy fields reverse themselves at the end of the day and towards midnight. It's completely 180-degree different than it is in the morning, as we talked about. And of course, we said when you reacclimate, this would cause jet lag, or meaning move your body with hydrogen atoms in it from one point to another. Now, going into the different names, let's just say we're looking at the physical plane. We've talked about the first, second, third etheric and ionic, or the fourth etheric state of the physical plane. If we back up, for example, to the astral plane, we would find two particles that live there that are known by science now, called the lepton and the hadron.
We really got to sign out here. Once again, the George Norrie Show on Coast to Coast AM. Look it up on the internet. 11 o'clock Pacific, and that'll be Friday night, February 4th. See you next week.